Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
I do think you need a very strong vision, and you need to be able to see that vision and paint it for others. Like, our favorite entrepreneur to invest in is someone who is deep in an industry. They know something really well, and they understand that opportunity in that industry extremely well. And it's just clear in their mind what that vision for a better version of the industry or the product or, you know, the process, whatever it is. And that's very clear in their mind. And so you can say that sort of verges on success is inevitable in that they know what that looks like. They know what that future looks like.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Minnie, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. So I actually found out about you by way of a publicist who told me a bit about your story and the work that you've done in venture capital, the startups that you've built, and I was very, very intrigued by all of it. But before we get into that, as you know from having heard the show, I want to start with something that has nothing to do with your work, and that is, what is one of the most important things that you learned from one or both of your parents that influenced and shaped who you've become and what you've ended up doing with your life?
You know, that's a good question. I sometimes think that I'm now a parent, right? And yeah. I think that, you know, how do you learn to be a good parent? And there is no way to learn to be a good parent. And I think, you know, we're all bad parents in our own special ways. But I think just the example they set, I think that you can't be a good, the easiest way to be a good parent is to have good examples around you. And they left me feeling very loved and supported. And that's kind of a general statement. I think, you know, to kind of go a little bit more specific, my mother in particular, she's 80. And her generation, I think, was taught to have children and marry, you know, a man with a stable job, or that's what she took from it. And she had five kids. And she, I think, was kind of almost like a sort of stereotypical immigrant, first generation tiger mom or something, who really cared about the value of education. And she saw education as sort of the path to, you know, having whatever career you wanted. And so, you know, I really value that I got an amazing education. I think it's been very foundational for me, just my career, but also like my confidence.
Yeah. So I always wonder this about kids of immigrants, particularly if you are, you know, one of many siblings, and in your case, you know, one of five. Where in the birth order do you fall, and how did the advice differ from one kid to another? Because I know that I always said, you know, my sister got away with murder in comparison to what I did. Like what she did would have gotten me basically grounded for life.
Yes. Oh, definitely. So first off, I'm not actually a child of immigrants. It's just that they okay. act that way. just to be clear, it's just that my mom acts that way. But no, I'm number four of five. And, oh, wow. And, you know, there were different things. So yes, I kind of got away with murder, but, my father at some point, I think when he was having his fifth child, or when we were growing up, he tended to say no credit, no blame. And I think it was his way of saying, you know, you can try your hardest to have an athlete or have a, you know, creative, you know, songwriter, a musician, but at some point the children have their own personalities. And I think that was, it made them a little bit more relaxed about our upbringing by child four and child five. I was again, number four. But yes, the birth order made a big difference, but also our personalities did. And so I know that my sibling, who's number three and number five, the two on either side of me, are incredibly smart and athletic and talented and never had to work very hard and kind of always got A minuses and were always sort of happy. And my parents always told them to work a little harder because they didn't really like, they just didn't like, you know, it was just everything was easy for them. And so they kind of skated through life. My parents were always like, you know, try to light a little fire under their butts. And for me, I think I always got an A and worked really hard and cared a whole lot, you know, especially as a child when everything was a big deal. And they always told me kind of to, you know, A minuses are fine, like chill out a bit. B pluses are fine. And so, you know, I think the advice varied by child.
Well, A minuses are fine and B pluses are okay is something you will never hear from an Indian parent. Like, I remember my roommate asking me, he said, "You got straight A's in high school, didn't you?" I was like, "Yeah." That was just not a negotiable thing. If you brought home a B, it was just like, "What the hell happened? Why did you get a B?"
Okay, I actually, as soon as I said that, I was like, I don't know whether B pluses were fine. I think an A minus was fine. I'm not sure about the B plus, but it was also, that was unique to me. It was not true of my siblings. That was unique to me because I was more at risk for dropping out of school, for being like a hot mess, because I was so driven and I cared so much about, and I don't know where it came from, but I was passionate about sort of about being competitive and winning. And a lot of that came out in sports, but some of it came out in the academic side too. Wow.
What did you learn about social dynamics and human relationships and interaction from being part of such a big family, especially being 4 out of 5?
I think that not to judge other people a bit. So I'm the 4th, and my 3 older siblings all had 3 children before I had 3 children. I now have 3 children. I think very highly of my 3 older siblings. They're all people I admire. And yet before I had children, I would watch them parent and I would think, oh, you know, she's too strict and no fun. And he's too lax and, you know, just indulges and goes to Target with his children and buys them whatever they want. You know, I had these ways of judging my siblings. I hope they never listen. but what you learn is actually, there is no right way of doing things or living your life. And it, you know, it kind of all works out in the end. So I kind of learned to be a little less judgmental, although, you know, that took some time. I'm still work in progress on that.
Well, I think that all of us have that sort of degree of, okay, you know what? I am definitely not going to do this one thing that my parents did. And I was talking to my best friend who we had here as a guest on the podcast. And we were talking about, you know, the fact that he has a 15-year-old teenager and a newborn. And I asked him, I said, you know, do you find yourself doing things that you swore that you would never do that you saw your own parents do? And he said, you know, as much as I hate to admit it, yes, there are days. He said that, you know, when we were growing up, our parents kind of refused to answer the question of why whenever they told us anything. It was just like, I'm the adult, don't ask why. And he said that sometimes he does end up finding himself having to have those conversations with his daughter, who, you know, as a teenager, continually challenges him. You've obviously, you know, chosen the entrepreneurial path. So I wonder 2 things. One, what, if any, career advice did your parents give you about making your way in the world? And as a parent, and I don't know how old your kids are, but how has that influenced the kind of way you think about, you know, giving your kids career advice, particularly because of the fact that you've had a career path where we know as entrepreneurs, as creatives, that you're signing up for a life where nothing is guaranteed?
Yeah. I'm not sure. In fact, I was going to say, I'm not sure what career advice they gave me. But actually that it itself is an answer, which is they didn't give much career advice. So much for a few reasons. They gave some. They were full of advice, and I liked getting their advice, in fact. But they gave me values, very much so. And so my dad is a professor, and my mother was a nurse when the 5 of us were going through private school. And they cared a lot about sending us to a good school, which in our case ended up being private school. And they really never cared about money. And, my dad's a professor, but we didn't have a ton of money having 5 kids in private school. One thing I did take from them was, like, there was never a pursuit of money. Like, we drove a Pinto and we had a nice garden in the backyard, and we were very happy in kind of doing our thing. And, and it's interesting now because I am a venture capitalist, which, sounds to me very much like someone who would be pursuing, you know, returns and fame and fortune or something, but that was definitely not a value they had, or that I took from them. It wasn't one they gave us. They did give me different advice. Like and usually it was kind of towards the stable job direction. I think maybe similar to sort of a traditional immigrant parent, like there was a, you know, be a doctor. I wanted to be a math teacher at one point. I thought maybe I would feel very fulfilled teaching math to high school students, especially high school girls. I was good at math and computer science, and I thought maybe I should, you know, teach math and computer science. And I still think that. But my mom said, well, you will be able to do that. You know, I think that door won't be closed to you. If you go and excel at math and computer science at Google, they will still take you at the high school to teach computer science to high school kids. So so I think she was definitely about, you know, being ambitious in our careers. And there was definitely an expectation that we were all going to college and yeah. we were all going to be, I don't remember, like national merit scholars, I think was her thing. So
I can relate. I mean, my dad's a professor as well. So I get that, you know, it's there's no question as to whether we're ever going to go to college.
But here was the thing, like my dad's a professor, my mom was a nurse. Neither of them knew anything about business. And so they're really, if you're a child of a professor, like they had all this advice on like how to do research and how to do primary research, how to do secondary research. But like, I never, like what a management consultant did, what a venture capitalist did, what a investment banker, any of that was completely opaque. And I didn't, you know, no one sort of explained what different careers looked like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as an investor, you know, the reason that this comes to my mind, as an investor and a parent, you know, you probably invest in young founders. And I remember this was literally, we raised our first round of venture funding. And my mom was talking to me about, you know, arranging dates with, you know, friends of theirs. And they're like, well, we're going to have to tell them that your income is unstable and, you know, all this other shit. And I was like, wow, you guys have really undersold me. Like, you're not going to mention the fact that I wrote two books with a publisher and I raised a round of venture funding. And my mom said, don't get mad, but have you thought about getting a job? I was like, wait a minute, we just raised a round of investor money. Like, really? So I wonder, as an investor, what do you, you know, a lot of parents are listening to this. You know, some of them probably have kids who are going to go out and follow this sort of crazy entrepreneurial path, particularly there are because they're people who listen to our show. What advice do you have for the parents of the types of people that you invest in?
Advice for the parents. I mean, the good news is I think that entrepreneurship has become a career path or something. I mean, I don't know, as in it's increasingly something that is, you know, it is, you can study it in school, you can study an undergrad entrepreneurship, you can then get an MBA that focuses on entrepreneurship. You can learn it as a skill, if you will. And so I think that, you know, I so I think there's that side of things. On the other side of things, you know, from where I sit, like it is an intense, incredible amount of learning. It sets you up to be so much more wise and successful in whatever you do next, because you've been drinking from the fire hose for however many number of years. And that sort of learning is invaluable. And I think increasingly, you know, your traditional employers, I worked at Google and did, you know, endless numbers of hiring committee hours. Increasingly employers recognize the value of not only, you know, let's say launching a product, but launching a company. And so I don't know if that's quite advice for the parents, but increasingly I think there's great examples of people who are entrepreneurs and, you know, can also have families and have reasonably steady incomes. But like you said, like things like looking at rounds of funding, you know, I tell people when they're applying for jobs, like, is this a well-funded company? How many months of runway? And things are much more stable if you've got 12, 18 months of runway in the bank than if you don't. So there's some practical things you can do.
Yeah, for sure. I guess the, you know, other part of this I wonder is, yeah, I mean, there's no question, like you're signing for a lot of concern, but yeah, it's funny you talk about how valuable this is, because I realize now after 10 years of Unmistakable Creative, like I was pretty much unemployable after I finished business school. And I realize now that if I did go to choose and apply for a job, I actually have so much more value that I can bring that actually is tangible from having spent 10 years working on this project. And I developed skills I would have never developed in any other capacity.
Yeah. And I look for that when I look at people's resumes. And, you know, I used to sort of be thinking, okay, how many years of experience does someone have in the workforce? Like, what year did they graduate college? Just as a starting point, so I understand, like, how many years of experience. And then, okay, well, they graduate from undergrad 10 years ago, but then they did get an MBA. So I kind of discount that in my mind. I'm like, instead of 2 years, that's like 1 year's worth of, like, work experience. but then like founder of a startup that, you know, raised a Series A or something. I'm like, oh, they have, you know, that's like a plus one in my mind. So I think, you do learn so much. And more importantly, maybe to me, is I think so many people like myself and maybe like you don't know what career direction is right for them. And so much of startups, you get exposed to so much and there's so much work to do that you kind of can naturally gravitate to things. And I've seen so many people who thought that they were, a business, financial forecaster who actually turn into business development people, because their skills kind of emerge in the course of building a startup. And so then when they actually go back into the work, like the normal workforce or something, they're just more settled in knowing the right, like they have the right skill match for what job is actually good for them.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Yeah, well, it's funny because I had David Epstein here who wrote a book called Range, which was, you know, talking about the power of being a you know, generalist in a specialized world. And he said that often, you know, finding a match is really one of those things that really determines your ability to succeed. And he said, you know, match quality is such a huge thing. And yet I feel like so often, you know, when you go to a job, it's like, oh, you know, these are the bullet points on my resume. These are the jobs that I can apply for. And as a result, you end up with sort of this mismatch between talent and environment. I'm 100% sure that's what happened to me because I was a creative person who never got to have a creative job and as a result had just piss poor performance in the job world. So one, how do we deal with that? Like, how do you avoid having that happen, particularly because that's kind of how we hire right out of college? The other thing that I wonder about is you know, you and I both come from, you know, fairly educated backgrounds. We have parents who are college professors. I think that with that inevitably comes a sort of cognitive bias towards people who have degrees. Like my roommate always jokes with me, he's like, oh, you think this person's more credible because they're a doctor? I was like, I'm Indian. Of course I think that. Like I've been talking about that my entire life. But particularly in the Valley and places like Google, I mean, I was a Berkeley undergrad, so I know that the sort of filter is, oh, you have the Ivy League checkbox. And I think that cognitive bias is there. How do you deal with that in the world of hiring? Like, how do people overcome it if they're the ones trying to get hired? And how do other people make sure they're not letting their cognitive biases dictate their choices and overlooking potentially extraordinary people?
So many different pieces to that. You know, one piece is sort of your classic best practices, I think, for hiring, again, filtered through me, is that you really want to identify what success looks like in 18 months for the role, and then what are the skills that the person needs to have success in that role in 18 months, let's say. And so I being very clear and crisp about what those skills are ahead of time, skills or attributes that you're looking for, and you can't have a list of, you know, 100 of those, it needs to be like four or five that you're looking for. And being really clear on that upfront, I think, helps you then sort of filter people based on, are they a fit for the skills that you've identified? And the skill, you know, is something like the ability to scale or sell, or someone who's gone through rapid growth before, and it's not, you know, went to got this XYZ degree or another. Right. I also think that kind of to the what we were talking about with startups is your ability to show why you are qualified to do the work. It helps if you've done, you know, some of that work before, which is why something like a startup that exposes you to a lot of work is great, because you can sort of say, look, I have done something like this before. And then when you're applying to the right job, you've actually, you know what you're talking about in terms of, you know, here's what I would do to be successful. Here's what I do in my first 3 months, 6 months, 18 months. And you can actually, you know, speak credibly about that. And then, you know, for me, I am extremely educated and look, my mom likes to say I look good on paper. and at some point, yes, like I don't need another brand name, whatever. But I do vet when I look at resumes, which again, I don't look at resumes anymore. I think, resumes have stopped being, you know, how I hire, but, you know, the people who we talk about distance traveled and the people who've had interesting narratives, it's much more interesting that you ended up at, you know, getting your MBA if you dropped out of high school. That's an interesting story. And someone who's shown that they can persevere or something versus like, you know, we all went to Stanford. Great. You went to Stanford, you know, exciting. I don't know, something like that.
Yeah. Well, let me give you a counterexample to this, because this is something that I've wondered. You know, we hired a community manager sometime right after we raised our round of funding, and, you know, our investors gave us a sort of a job description. They're like, okay, do this, this, and this. And everybody who met the job description, like people who applied, I was like, this is really, I thought we would have a much easier time. So I actually reached out to one of our listeners, and she said, Trini, I'm a civil engineer with a PhD. I don't know shit about social media or building community. And she has been hands down the best community manager I've ever seen. It's been remarkable what she's done, because my thought process was like, okay, you're a civil engineer with a PhD, you're smart and you know how to solve problems. That's pretty much all we need. The rest of this you can learn with no experience. And she was 1,000 times better than candidates who actually, you know, on paper matched the job description.
Yeah. I mean, sort of like being an investor, there's a lot of when we invest that is a gut driven decision where, but that kind of goes with the distance traveled aspect, which is if I've seen that you can solve problems in other realms, like you excelled in doing X, you excelled in doing Y, then, and so it's, to me, it's like, oh, you were able to do different things and do well at them. Then here's another different thing that you'll probably do well at. So you could argue that that was the profile that you're looking for, someone who's a great problem solver, or, you know.
Yeah. Well, let's do this. Let's shift gears. Let's talk about the trajectory that has actually led you to where you're at today as an investor. Because I know that you've built startups, you've worked at Google. What in the world led you down this path? Like, how did you end up where you're at today?
So, strictly speaking, grew up in LA. I then went to Stanford and thought that maybe I'd study math because, you know, this is the 90s. It was a little before computer science, but then it was very clear that computer science was like just going crazy. Like, it was so much innovation coming out of computer science. Companies were launching. It was just a dynamic place. So I ended up studying computer science. So went to Stanford to study computer science, ended up going to Harvard to get my MBA, went to Google. It all sounds like very, I don't know, linear. But in truth, like when I went to Stanford, the first thing I did was I dropped out of Stanford at the end of my freshman year because I just couldn't handle it. It was, as I said, like I was really driven, but I just wasn't mature, and mostly I just got really out of whack, sort of emotionally, and got into just a bad depression, and ended up dropping out and thought I was dropping out of Stanford. But, if you go back a semester later, which I did, then they just say that you stopped out for a semester and you went back and graduated. And so, as my mother says, I look good on paper, but there were lots of sort of twists and turns in that path. So I went to Stanford, studied computer science, was part of a startup that IPO'd in March of 2000, right before the whole bubble burst. So that kind of led me to go to business school and went to business school and was good, got exposed to a lot of, the business things, but then was pretty sure after spending 2 years in Boston that I was very eager to move back to California and be back in tech. So I finished my MBA and didn't have a job, and everyone else had a job. And I was like, I'm going to move to San Francisco and see what's there. And actually, it was my mother who sent me the job description for Google, which, people think that because I went to Stanford and Google at that time was still very heavy on Stanford grads. But actually, they had an advertisement on the Google homepage that said, you're brilliant, we're hiring. My mother, of course, sent it to me. It was like, you're brilliant and they're hiring. It's perfect. So that ended up being great because I joined in 2002, which is a couple years pre-IPO. And really just, there were 500 people when I joined, and I just felt like I got a front row seat to so much, just so many amazing people and so many big decisions. And I got to see a lot of sort of how Silicon Valley evolved over a decade by sort of sitting in the Google seat, which was, I don't want to say it was the center of it all, but there was a lot of great people and great things going on. So I stayed for a long time. And then I started my own company in 2013.
Wow. So there's one thing that when we think about starting your own company, I never forgot this because it was something that I remember hearing Chris Sacca say, and I've heard him say it in interview after interview after interview. He said, when you look at founders, I was like, what is the one thing they all have? And he said, every founder that we've talked to that has been a success believes that their success is inevitable. Now, as an investor, do you find that to be the case, that that's the level of conviction that everybody has? And do you think that that's something that somebody can cultivate, or is that just something that's inherent?
It's interesting. So I know Chris really well. So Chris and I shared an office for probably like 5 years of my Google tenure, and we started all these projects together. So it's funny to hear him say that. So he believes that all founders think their success is inevitable. And yet I would say about Chris that one of the things that I think drove Sacca very like strongly was almost, I hope he's okay with me saying this, almost an insecurity. And, he was brilliant. And so maybe, I don't think he believed that his success was inevitable, but, maybe he did, but, he had a little chip on his shoulder. I think that he didn't go to an Ivy League school. Now I'm blanking on where he went to school. It wasn't like a bad school at all. And I think he had something to prove, and maybe he believed he had it in himself. Like he believed highly in himself, but he was also extremely insecure, which maybe is part of a founder's success. My general thought on entrepreneurs is that they take all shapes and sizes. And I don't believe that all founders that are successful have any one sort of trait. And I think that maybe a decade ago, there used to be a little bit more of a formula to being a successful entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Or not a formula, but just like it was more constrained. There were fewer options because you kind of had to look a certain way or do a certain thing in order to raise money because people were expecting you to have, you know, a certain characteristics. Increasingly, like when we invest, we talk about different personas, or we don't spend a lot of time trying to classify personas, but like, but you know, we can have a really nerdy founder who is maybe soft-spoken, but just has nailed the technology. We can have someone who's great at sales. And I don't think anymore that there's one certain type and that everyone has to believe that their success is inevitable. And it also depends on whether you're talking about your personal success or the success of your personal idea, because those are a little different concepts. But yeah, I do think you need a very strong vision, and you need to be able to see that vision and paint it for others. Like our favorite entrepreneur to invest in is someone who is deep in an industry. They know something really well, and they understand that opportunity in that industry extremely well. And so it's just clear in their mind what that vision for a better version of the industry or the product or, you know, the process, whatever it is. And that's very clear in their mind. And so you can say that sort of verges on success is inevitable in that, like, they know what that looks like. They know what that future looks like. Yeah, long answer there.
No, absolutely. Well, it's funny you talk about traits and sort of personas, because like I, you know, as the guy who got fired from every job I ever had, never imagined a million years I'd be a person to go raise a seed round from somebody. And I did. And I was just like, oh, wow, I had no idea I'm capable of this. So you mentioned traits. I want to come back to traits because I think there's probably more there. But you also mentioned insecurity. And I can tell you, I think that to some degree, part of this was driven by bosses who told me I wasn't, you know, interested in controlling my own destiny and things like that, where I was just like, yeah, screw you. I'm going to prove you wrong. I was like, you're a guy who's worked at the same company for 20 years and you're telling me I'm not interested in controlling my own destiny. But, you know, like I said, it was like this sort of chip on my shoulder. But I also realized there was a point at which I had to let that go if I was going to really channel my energy into this in a healthy way. So what that makes me wonder about is, you know, as founders, as people who build things, as creatives, one of the big challenges we face is not letting our self-worth become intertwined with the results that our business is producing or the success of our, you know, endeavor. You know, it's like, oh, I'm less of a person because my book didn't hit some bestseller list, or somebody else's audience is bigger than mine. And so one of the unfortunate byproducts of that is that we've had basically what is a mental health crisis in, you know, sort of the startup community, that, you know, I think people like Jerry Colonna are doing amazing work to address this. But I feel like it takes an Aaron Schwartz story for us to say, oh, wait a minute, this is a serious problem. And then we kind of write about it, we talk about it, and then it goes back to being, you know, just something that we know is there, but we don't address. And as somebody who is an investor, how do you counsel people through that? Because, I mean, there's no, especially now, particularly in the time of pandemic, like we were like, wow, our runway is shorter than we thought. Like I had a temporary meltdown until I realized, okay, this isn't as bad. But how do you counsel people through this aspect of the things?
Right. And especially, I mean, because I told you a little, like part of my story is also having my own, I pretty much have had to drop out of life twice myself. So it's definitely a topic I care about because I've sort of lived it myself. You know, I think for me, my I have a new favorite word. It's anecdata. My N of one, if you will, was what really helped me get through my own tough times was being able to talk about what I was going through, as opposed to having it sort of be a secret or be something that I felt like I carried myself. And then to be able to be willing to accept the help of others, and to have others then be around me who were there to really give me the help that I needed. And so, you know, I know that sounds very simple, but I would start with being able to talk about what's going on. And for me, it does diffuse things. And I know that about myself, which is keeping my mouth open, talking about what's going on does help me diffuse the severity of it. And, you know, to give you a quick example from my startup journey, we had to do a RIF at one point where we had to fire a bunch of people, not for performance related reasons. It was really causing me a huge amount of anxiety, and I wasn't sleeping, and I couldn't sort of be my usual self. And it weighed on me for many weeks. And then we started talking about it. And we talked about it with our board in particular, and it then took all the edge off. And you know, then we came up with like an action plan for how to do this in a thoughtful, caring way. I mean, it now seems like sort of a small thing. Lots of startups go through rifts, but just the act of talking about it helped immensely. So I think that is some of it. I also, for me, not that this helps, but it is the silver lining, which is having gone through a lot of hard things that were hard for me, you know, like the hardship of dropping out of Stanford may not sound like hardship to someone who's struggling to feed their family. But for me, it was extremely hard, extremely dark. But having gone through hard things has made me a better person and has made it much easier to go through subsequent things in life. So I will at least share that it has lots of silver linings to get through the other side, but you do have to get through the other side. My mother's expression is chop wood, carry water, which is sort of you have to just keep putting one foot in front of the other until it gets better, even if you don't believe that it gets better.
So one thing I wonder is talking about it, do you think it's easier to talk about it as a woman than it is as a man?
Yes. Because,
so that's, you know, the reason being, I think that men are encouraged to sort of put on this sort of superhero mindset. Like, I am very cognizant of the fact that if I'm going through something difficult, I'm very mindful about who I talk about it with. I basically do not make any public assertions, because I'm always like, oh, everything I do now is a reflection of my literary agents, my publishers, my investors. So I'm like, okay, this fundamentally changes your behavior. In fact, I remember writing about this, like my first 6 months of, you know, like dealing with venture funding and how different it was, and how basically you have this sort of bizarre combination of passion and stoicism, because you still need the passion that got you to this place in the first place and that willingness to take risks. But you also have to be able to have a sort of logical and analytical approach to everything that you didn't quite have before.
Yeah, it is easier. I think I do believe that it is easier for women in some ways, but I think that finding the channels that are the easiest is because it's the way that has worked for me. And there have been times where I've seen this, where, you know, an unwillingness to talk maybe sort of merited, like you may get judged, right? Like, who knows? Like, you may get judged for being weak or for being fired or for being insecure or whatever. And so for me, like having a career coach has been a tool that I have used. And I've also seen sort of, I had a bunch of co-founders who were all men, and we all had different career coaches, and extremely valuable to have resources, the career coach. And also we used our board a lot, not quite for therapy, but to talk through the hard things about our startup. And so, you know, it may be that there are certain channels that are easier than others, but at the same time, I think the world is moving to liking, trusting, caring about people who are authentic to who they are, and people who share the things that are going well. And it used to be that, you know, we wanted everyone to sort of wear a suit, look perfect, not acknowledge that their children might jump into their podcast at any moment. And now, you know, I think there's a blending of sort of our polished work selves with our at home regular selves that, I think that blending is also leading to sort of see the more authentic, fuller picture of people. And I think that's helping.
Yeah. Well, let's do this. Let's talk specifically about how a startup goes from being sort of, you know, in this phase of a couple of founders working together to, you know, sort of becoming this like massive empire that ends up, you know, leading to an IPO. So how does that actually happen, and what actually prevents people from getting there? Like, how do people screw this up too?
I think it's actually less that you screw it up and more that everything has to work perfectly to actually get there from startup to IPO. So how does it get going? As I said, I think one of the best ways to start is to have to be starting something that is your life passion, regardless of how the startup journey goes. And so, the pitches I see, it's, you know, someone who saw the need at their daycare center for a better CRM system, and they've had three kids go through the daycare center, versus someone who owns a franchise of 10 daycare centers and is spending their whole time and has done this for 20 years running daycare centers, and now decides to build software for themselves that then turns into a company. And there's a subtle difference there, but having a startup is more like an extension of who you are and what you know you want to spend decades on, because it's, you know, the journey from startup to IPO is probably a decade long. And so it's not something to enter into lightly. But there's a sort of traditional path, which is, okay, you raise a friends and family round of funding. My stage where 10110 invests, where our fund invests, is sort of someone's second seed round before raising a Series A. And when I was raising money for Shift, there was a seed round and then a Series A. And now there's at least two rounds, I would say, before a Series A. And then you go through your march up and down Sand Hill Road and go to the Monday partner meeting. And now Sand Hill Road is more in San Francisco. But more all over the country, which is great. But it's not a linear path ever. As I said, like our journey of going seed Series A, then we did a riff, and then we did a Series B. It's rarely sort of even ideas that take off, they sometimes take off, and then plateau.
Yeah. As I'm learning from having done the seed round and how different this is than I thought it would be. But one thing that I wonder, you mentioned a decade, and there's something that I always remember, and I always give this advice to people who want to write books, who want to start anything. You may have heard it. Sam Altman did a class at Stanford, basically, which was literally like Y Combinator's incubator at Stanford. And they made the whole thing available as a podcast. And I go through it at least once a quarter because I think the advice in there is invaluable. But one thing that always stayed with me that he said, and he tells this to founders, is that your greatest competitive advantage is a long-term view. And he defines that as 10 years. And I think that in a world where you can go from idea to execution in record time, people expect to have success just as quickly. What do you say to that? How do you get people out of that mindset? Because I do think that often, people will say, oh, I've been working on this blog for a year and nobody reads it. It's like, dude, do you have any idea how long most people have been working on their projects that actually have an audience?
Yeah. But the other piece of this that's really important is that one of the biggest advantages that startups have versus big companies is their ability to move fast. And so you need the long-term view, but you need to be constantly moving as fast as you can, because what happens to most startups that don't make it, the number one thing, is they run out of money. And it's not because there's often startups that I see where they're actually starting to go, like they're starting to really have some traction. Things are picking up, they're finding their voice, they're finding their audience. But so what? If you run out of money, you run out of money.
Yeah.
The need to move fast is sort of inherent in the way our current sort of venture startup process works. And my lesson of Shift was we moved fast on everything. And I learned just to move faster than I'd ever moved on just launching and iterating and getting feedback, except for on people. And I am a believer on not trying to move too fast on everything as it relates to HR and people. And so I don't disagree with Sam's advice on the long-term view,
right.
But I just think that needs to be balanced with, within that long-term view, you're moving extremely quickly. And if one thing is working, but, or not working, the need to tweak things, to play with things, to listen to customer feedback, because you can look at the trajectory you're on. And if you're growing, you know, whatever percent quarter over quarter, and that percent is not fast enough to either get you to your next round of funding, or to sort of show the explosive growth that will be needed for your next round of funding, you can't just sort of, you know, you need to sort of map out where you're going to be cash wise and where you're going to be growth wise and make sure that that gets you to the next milestone.
Trust me, I'm learning all of that firsthand. I spend more time doing cash flow analysis than I ever thought I would be doing. It's kind of like I'm calculating runway almost every other day. I think that that's one thing I realized was that, you know, you go from being sort of this creative person with this idea to suddenly when you have somebody else's money on the line, your thought process differs quite a bit. It's almost like you still have the idealism, but you also balance it with a lot of reality that I think is often missing from a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, when people call it a friends and family round, I don't know where you raised your money from, but I raised it from friends and a couple family members, but really mostly friends who I asked for money. And these were, you know, my Stanford friends who I took money from. And yeah, your calculation when it's a hobby project is very different than when you've taken money from your friends. And, you know, you really want to pay your friends back. And they took a bet on you and all of that. So absolutely, there's a different level of intensity, which again can lead to this, you know, when you talk about getting so caught up in your identity as your startup, it's also, I mean, it's not just about, you know, for your own personal glory or, you know, success. It's also because you feel obligation towards others to be successful and hiring people, you then have a huge obligation towards. So yeah, finding other ways of staying grounded, super important. And I managed to have three children while having a startup, which kept me very, at least not able to focus entirely on the startup, but to have other things that were more important to me was useful.
Well, speaking of which, I mean, I know one of the things that I remember looking, you know, when I was looking through your bio is what are the challenges do you think of being a woman, particularly in a male dominated environment? And what would you want men to understand about the challenges that female founders face? Because there's one story I remember that Paul Graham told in that Stanford class where he said that, you know, he tweeted a graph of a startup that was having explosive growth and it was from a female founder, but he never mentioned that it was a female founder and immediately he got everybody's attention. But he also said he wondered if it would have been the same if it had been a female founder.
So, you know, I think there's been a huge amount of change. The change I've felt in being female in a fairly male-dominated world or industry, it just things have the tenor of every of a lot of things have changed. From where I'm sitting, in that I was chatting on my podcast with Jessie Draper, who used to she hosted a talk show that was a tech talk show, and she got just constantly criticized for wearing pink and wearing skirts and being sort of valley girl-ish, and I think that. Now people are, women and men are conscious of noticing people who are underrepresented, minorities, or just people who are, you know, not the most assertive, not, you know, the voices that are sort of banging the table the loudest. And I see in just all sorts of different regards that I think things have gotten better and changed. For me, the thing that has sort of stuck with me is the mentorship that I've received and that I feel now has come a lot of times in small acts of kindness or thoughtfulness that people have displayed that have really touched me and emotionally, but also I think changed, you know, had real impact on my career. And I think that there's one, I think people are just sort of trying to be more thoughtful and helpful. But also I think that it's not always a one-to-one mentorship relationship where people who I barely know have, you know, said something, done something that's really had these butterfly wing effects on me. And so I try to remember that sort of when I go through my life, if there's something I can do and say to be helpful, I try to squeeze in like an extra call with someone who's looking for advice or, you know, just try to be helpful when people are looking for help in one form or another.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've seen probably the widest range of, you know, successes and failures. I mean, having been at Google, having been an investor, one thing I wonder is how much of this, you know, this is like a Guy Raz question that he asks everybody at the end of how I built this, like how much of sort of becoming an Airbnb or a unicorn of like a Stripe or somebody is luck and how much of it is just pure hard work and execution?
I think that there is being positioned to be able to take advantage of the luck that comes your way. And so being positioned there, meaning you have the skills, you have the background, but also you have your eyes wide open to opportunity and then take advantage of it. I mean, that's the story of my career has definitely been, I had nothing planned ahead of time. I was not aiming to be a venture capitalist. I was very much trying to understand where the opportunity in the world was. And so I think it's both.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because I remember even when we raised our round, there was basically Radio Public started a venture fund called Pod Fund. And I remember like looking at the Facebook group that day, like, you know, podcasters were just yapping about it and talking about it and, you know, talking about what they would do with the money. I literally went and filled out an application. I was like, this is what I'm going to do with the money. This is how I'm going to use it. This is what we're going to do. It was like, you know, and it was kind of amazing, like how fast it all happened. But I realized the difference was very simple. I didn't sit around talking about it. I instead went and acted on it.
Yeah. Well, and my training is as a product manager. And a product manager, one of the main jobs of a product manager is say, what does the user want? What does the user need? And I feel like I've internalized that into some of how I run my life, which is what is the world telling me that it needs or wants that's sort of a fit for my skills? And, you know, I think I sort of not quite stumbled into being a venture capitalist, but it was a very good fit for what I felt like there was a need in the market and it played well to my strengths. But understanding, you know, not trying to always force a rock up a hill or swim upstream or whatever, but really finding those opportunities where there's big tailwinds.
Mm-hmm. So one thing I wonder is, you know, when somebody is in a startup where they run out of money, I mean, you see a situation where it's like, okay, that's it. The money's out. Like we're closing the doors. How do people recover a sense of identity after that, especially when their sense of identity has been intertwined with something for so long? Because like after doing this for 10 years, I think I would definitely have like a few months if that actually happened, God forbid, where I really wouldn't know what to do with myself.
Yeah. You know, I haven't been doing this long enough to have a whole lot of companies that have had to sort of shut down as dramatically. I think it is often a bit of a transition. Like I have seen a couple people who've, you know, the money doesn't just, you know, it's not like it goes to from 100 to zero all at once. And so I've seen people who maybe have picked up consulting jobs that are tangentially related. Maybe they've carried on with the idea, but, you know, just on their own as more of a hobby. I think each situation is really different, for each person. And, but it's hard, right? I do think we get so caught up in work as our identity, which is why it's nice. It is nice if you have other things outside of work that are also, you know, that you can cultivate so that, you know, as I said, like I got so caught up in work, but then, you know, I had a 1-year-old who was trying to drown himself in the bath and all of a sudden that became, you know, a more important focus. And it was useful for me to have things that balanced me or else I would have just been 100% nothing but my startup all the time.
Yeah. So one thing I wonder, you know, as somebody who's been successful at a startup, you've, you know, grown a startup to the point where it's scaling, you're a venture capitalist. How has your perspective on money and wealth changed, both with, you know, the success you've experienced and with age?
Oh, well, I mean, the thing that I end up thinking about the most, a few things. So one, the thing I think about the most is how is our society gonna get back on an upward trajectory? And the thing that as I've sort of just grown older and seen more things is just we don't have the privilege to be doing what we're doing unless we are looking at the bottom half of society and finding solutions to make our society as a whole works. And it's okay with me if that's for selfish reasons. Like if that's because we don't want to end up in a society where we're all living in gated communities, and that's a selfish reason to try to help everyone come along, great. If it's a much more altruistic thing, which is nobody should be unable, you know, no mother should be sitting there saying, I want to be able to feed my family, but I can't. So I think just the awareness of what I care about in the world, you know, has become more clear to me. So on that side, on the other side, I think that, I grew up, as I said, with this academic family and didn't really understand the power of the people who are the capital allocators, in this world and the power of the people who, you know, they are money managers for billion dollar endowments or huge PE funds. You know, how that money gets allocated really is a driver of so much of how our society functions and what we focus on. So I think like my awareness of who's controlling the purse strings in sort of the supply chain, you know, everything up from the startup gets money from me, the VC, but I have LPs and my fundraise is a difficult fundraise. So understanding who are my limited partners giving me the money and then where are those limited partners driving their money? And, you know, that's just the startup supply chain, but, you know, super interesting when you look at, you know, the multi-trillion dollar energy market or anything else, understanding where the capital is coming and going.
Yeah. Wow. Well, this has been fascinating. So I have one final question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews at the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
It is the energy of the person or thing for me. And it's not, I'm a high energy person and I don't mean that it's high energy. I just mean it's a positive energy. I'm sitting here looking out my window at some trees that have beautiful energy. Gosh, I spent 2 decades in San Francisco. But truly, I do think that the energy that people put out into the world is one of the things that attracts me to, you know, like a moth, like to someone who has incredible positive energy. And it doesn't need to be incredible high energy, but just the people who project peace. That's what I'm drawn to.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story and your insights with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and everything else that you're up to?
Sure. I'm Minnie Ingersoll on LinkedIn, probably is an easy place for people to connect directly. And then I host my podcast where I talk with other VCs and I'm learning a lot from this show. I'm going to ask them more probing questions, but I'm talking to VCs about what they invest in, what they care about at LA Venture.
Cool. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.